This is a Collider.com audio interview.
Oh, we're doing Q&A here?
Yep.
All right.
When is the public going to see this trailer?
Right in front of Harry Potter. So in 3 weeks? 15? We've been working a long time on it. Disney's done an amazing job. We were not nice citizens. We just kept saying it wasn't good enough. It felt like other trailers. It felt like other movies. And I just really wanted... You know, Steve Jobs told me a great thing once, is you only make a first impression once. And so we just kept holding off until we felt we had a trailer that represented what it felt like to watch the movie. And they finally nailed it. And so I'm kind of happy that it took this long.
Well, what was the song in the trailer?
That is Peter Gabriel doing a cover of Arcade Fire. Cool on Cool.
Did you find that in the construction of a trailer, it was imperative to not have a lot of close-up, here's everything moments?
Yes, I hate that.
Right.
I hate that. And I feel that the audience is smarter than that. And they've heard me rant this way too many times. But I said, you know, give them some credit. I now hear anybody, I don't care what their age is, what their demographic is, where they come from, when they show a trailer with everything in, I hear somebody whispering, well, that's the whole movie, and so it must not be good. Because that all people see when they see that is that you're not confident in what you have and you're afraid. And that you assume your audience is dumb and won't get it. And so I really hate being, you know, if I have any, can I have any say in it? I don't want to go there. You know, I've been teased way too many times, very successfully for most of my career and my youth to know that it can be done. And it can be done every time. So it's just, it ends up being sometimes a reflection of the people doing it, but they can't feel it, and they don't, and so they point at other excuses.
You want an invitation last summer.
Yeah. I mean, we all want our kick in it, too. We say we want you to see more, but we actually don't. We just want to have a little bit of a sense that it won't be wasted our time to go to the theater.
To ask a slightly more ornate question, people have an innate understanding of the mechanics of gravity from living within it.
Uh-huh.
Do you find that conveying, obviously, Mr. Carter is in a lower gravity environment, hence mm-hmm. his capacity for jumping and feats of strength, but do you find you have to be careful about conveying that in a way where it parses logically for our standard perception of gravity?
Well, yeah, that's why I did the whole teaching scene. You know, I figured I had to teach you that it was different for him and that it was not easy. And he stays awkward for quite a while.
Can you talk a little bit about the fact that this is not 3D, and was there a lot of talk of going 3D?
Well, it's not 3D in the shooting of it. I have no say over whether it's 3D on the release of it, as far as whether they do prints that are 3D and stuff like that. So
you're saying that's an ongoing decision?
Well, no, I think they made the decision.
I can jump in on that a little bit. We didn't, for a lot of reasons, didn't shoot it in 3D out the gate, and it became... especially with some of the international territories, became more and more important as they're opening up. And it wasn't something we started out with, but when it became evident that we needed to kind of go that direction, fortunately, Disney supported a kind of elaborate and expensive approach to create a stereo version of the film. You know, there's so much CG in it that we have a lot of 3D elements already that we can do stereoscopic views of. So then the challenge was... How do you create dimension with the 2D elements, your human characters that you've shot flat? And we're going through a pretty elaborate process of creating geometry and sort of making 3D characters of them, if you will, so that we can do, you know, true stereo views, left, right, eye. And we were fortunately able to pull in Bob Whitehill, who's our Pixar mm-hmm. stereographer, who's really, we think, has immaculate taste in this, and it's not, you know, it gives it some dimensional feel. It's not, it's not spears chucked in your face kinds of moments in this thing. So we're trying to, you know, fortunately Disney supported in a way to do a really great version of it, even though it wasn't something we'd gone out the gate to do.
Yeah, I got to give them credit for, like, they didn't force it on me and allowed me to just, it was hard enough to leap to this medium and learn all these other things. And it was the same reason I didn't do it on WALL-E. It wasn't that I was so against it. It was more like, I have enough to worry about. I'm worried that it will be one more plate to spin that will distract me from trying to get the job done of making the film good. So it may just be the limitations of my brain, but it's the most I can handle.
Is Edgar Rice Burroughs actually a character?
He is in the books, so he is in the film, yeah.
When you're working on a work of fiction which is from the early 1900s and that depicts an era even prior to that, these are obviously different eras in terms of gender politics and racial sensitivity. Have you found yourself lightly massaging the tone and tenor of the novels?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't gonna go into places that were gonna cause controversy. You know, I didn't see the need to, and that's been an ongoing debate with the subject matter ever since it was written, and I didn't need to put my foot in that pool, so I made sure to just steer clear of it. There was really no need to.
Can you explain? This is sort of a silly question. How you can communicate with them after you clearly set up in the first scene.
You'll have to watch the film. Gotta have something to watch.
Can you talk a little bit? From what I understand, you're not going to Comic-Con. Are you going to Comic-Con?
No, you came here.
What you just showed us was fantastic. I'm just wondering if there was ever thought to showing that kind of presentation to, or just hoping that we're going to relay it to everybody.
I may be totally wrong on this, but I am done with hearing about stuff early out. As a fan, I just want to hear about it just this much, and I want to hear about it within a time frame that I can do something about it and go see it. And so
we should all hold our stories till February?
Well, I can't control that. I just feel like the real courageous people are going to be the people that can be patient in the future, if not now, of stuff. In anything, let alone movies. Patience is not a commodity that's easily come by anymore, and it's just dwindling more and more. And if you're going to give credit where credit's really due, come on, you got in line and waited hours because you didn't know what was going on for most of your youth. Mm-hmm. And we're part of the problem as much as we're part of the people that are lauding the very things we love and want them to be out there. And I'm trying to balance that so that it doesn't look stubborn, it doesn't look like we don't have something, you know. But there's a certain element of showmanship that I really, really was thankful for growing up on things. And so I want just enough, but I don't want too much, and I want it done in a way that, you know, and it's all a guessing game, but that's part of it. I didn't want to possibly, because you just don't know what's going to be at Comic-Con. I didn't want to get lost in the noise, and I wanted you guys to just sort of be able to focus on it and enjoy it, you know.
Well, how careful/aggressive do you have to be when you have already planned for 3 films coming right out of the gate?
What do you mean, how careful/aggressive? I'm sorry.
I mean, like, how, like, talking about the idea of not wanting to give too much away, but
yeah,
you have to, you know, try to generate enough of an audience with the first one to...
Well, yes and no. I mean, one, you've got to just know that something's out there, but I found, you know, and this is just from the boxed-in world I've been into Pixar for 20 years, is we only had one mantra from Steve Dan, which is just make it good. Everything else that you are worrying about will come if you make it good. There'll be missed opportunities, there may be things that feel like you could have taken advantage of more, there could be bad first impressions you might make, but really all you have control over is how good you make it. And so that's really where I want to put most of my efforts and not get distracted by how much or what's been put out there. I'm always going to be like, how little do we have to put out? How enjoyable can I make? Because I care about everything after you've gone to the theater. I care about that, like, will this be one of the movies that you might just want to take off the shelf and give your grandkid, you know? I'm in it for that. I'm not in it for the 6 months now. Now, I know I have to be to make sure people even go, but I am a believer that if something's really good, that people will get to it, and they'll flock to it, and whether it happens on the schedule and on the box office meter that everybody else would like it to, I don't have control over that. I only have control over that. Maybe if you pull it out now, you pull it out a year from now, you pull it out 10 years from now, 15 years from now, 50 years from now, you'll still might want to watch it. And I'm grateful to those movies. I'm just grateful to those movies every day. And so that's the only game I've been in, and that's how I've been taught. So I may even be a really horrible strategist on how to front load these things, you know. But I have to go with my gut as a movie goer. And my gut is, I want just enough to, like, get a sense of what I think the thumbprint is, get enough insurance that I don't think it's going to suck, and then you got me, and then I'll go, you know. And that's about how I'm going to play it, you know, as much as I can control it, so.
Well, I guess how strong, then, is the commitment to making three movies, no
matter how? Well, I think, you know, they strong enough that they said yes to option in the first three. Mm-hmm. But I think they're just being prudent, and I would be too, about, well, you know, this may not be everybody's cup of tea. You could still make it great, and, you know, and nobody wants to go, you know. And so I get that they're going to, I mean, I'm not waiting for a green light to be working on everything in case we go forward. So nothing's going to be affected creatively for it in a bad way. Mm. But I get the logistics of it. This is not a cheap franchise, and this is not a cheap world. You know, to do it right, you kind of have to go balls out.
You come from an environment where a lot of the creative process happens in the post-production, or I guess it's the... I was wondering, I heard you did a screening at Pixar, and then there was a bunch of reshoots.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you're trying to do that with this. You're bringing that process to this. Could you talk a little bit?
Yeah, you know, it's been interesting to compare apples to oranges, you know, now that we're out there. I mean, I've always seen live action as like the adults. They get to really make the movies, and we're just kids here doing our little thing. And I've always wanted to give it the intelligence and everything that, you know, and that's a bad trap you fall into. And the shocking thing when I got out there was like, oh my God, we actually know how to do it better on a lot of things, you know, back here. And I think some of that isn't because people are bad at their job, it's just that people are stuck in a certain way that it's always been done. And you can say that about any system. And Pixar sort of had this luxury of being ignorant and young and not knowing how it's done, and we just sort of saw from afar how we thought movies were made, and we used logic, and turns out that's not used that often in making movies. The other advantage is we sort of have a pseudo-studio system of the modern era. We have the same people working together again and again and again. It's like having the same team players on the same sports team for 20 seasons. And you get really good at all the things that you would never value. You know, how information is brought across to things. How things are delegated. You know, just the simplest, most mundane things have been honed down to their most efficient and smart way of what's best for the film thinking. And so I just saw nothing but improvement everywhere I went once I left this building. It was kind of overload. And, what got me off on that? The question was, for reshoots. And so, one of the other things is that I realized is that, you know, animation, because you can put it all up in drawing form, that you're not going to keep. It's in the grand scheme of things, it's a cheap way to make something. It's you draw it, you put your own voice on it, you cut it, and you don't like it, and you do it again. And you do it every 6 months over 3 to 4 years. Every time you do that, that's the equivalent of a reshoot. So I've been taught how to make a movie with 4 reshoots built in every time. That's how I've learned. And you wonder why our movies are good? It's not because we're smarter, it's not because we're better, it's because we are in a system that recognizes that you don't go, oh my God, okay, I'm going to paint this, but I can only touch the brush once, and I'm going to make one stroke, and that stroke's ass, then we're done, we're not making this painting. You know, it's like, I get to like, try it, play it, oh, don't like that, play it again, no, play it again, record it now, what if we use a different, I mean... It's most creative processes allow for somebody to go off into their shack, their studio, their recording booth, and try stuff until they figure it out and find it. But this is such an expensive way to make something creative, which is a movie. People freak. And they want to hold it all in, and they want to see, okay, can you just be really smart and think about it some more and plan some more, and then we'll just do it once, you know, or maybe twice. And most places now are not even letting you think about it. They're just like, just do it. Maybe you'll luck out. Mm-hmm. Well, we plan the bejesus out of it here. Like, I've never met people that plan it more than we do. And then we do it 4 times over. So, of course, it's like you kind of have no excuse. It's got to be good. And so my argument, I never had to argue, but my explanation to Disney when they were sort of going, why do we have to reshoot and why is this number so big? I said, you're taking somebody who's learned how to do it with three to four times and do it once. So I'm trying to be as smart as I could and raise the bar as high as I could with the script before we went shooting, knowing that I wasn't going to get the same amount of iterations. And then tried to be as smart as I could about how to be doing the reshoots. It's still less than what I'm used to. And then in a perfect world, I would somehow, but you start to understand the logistical problem of just trying to do that. You know, because it's such a gypsy culture. You don't get to keep the same people. They're not in that building. You can't just grab them on a Thursday and just go, what if we just do this? You know, all your actors are gone off. So it's a real conundrum. And believe me, we're trying to think of, like, if we do another one, how can we improve upon what we've learned? We've managed to do some of that with our thinking on this, but there's a huge room for improvement. But it's a gnarly problem. I get it.
Can you talk about the score? How much of that?
Oh no, all of that is scratch. I mean, okay. I'm sure you were thrown out of the picture, going, yeah. "Oh my gosh, that's from Wrath of Khan, that's from Lost, that's from whatever." And that's how we work. That's how we work with all our films. You just put in. You know, I try to use as much of the composer that's going to be on it to just get into the airspace of their grammar. And some composers don't want to hear what you've done, and some do. But for me, it's really helpful because then I'm not setting myself up for, it'd be like suddenly doing all your rehearsals with a different actor or actress, and then suddenly you for all that time, then you go, I want to start to be in the headspace of their lexicon, you know, their musical lexicon. So there's a lot of Giacchino in there, but I'll use whatever I need to get the tone I'm trying to get across.
Can you talk a little bit about the effect? Like, there's obviously a lot of creatures, a lot of effects. Can you talk about the companies you chose to do the effects and why you chose them?
We started with two and then ended up with three, partly just because the scope of this thing got a little bigger than we expected to. Most of the talent has all gone to London. Not that it wasn't there a lot before, but that's because it's a very gypsy atmosphere of all your talent, and they tend to go where all the work is, and all the work has gone to London over the last, I don't know, what, 6 years, 5 years?
Yeah.
And it's now just like full bore going on, showing no signs of stopping. So your actual, like, who's going to literally be down pounding the nails, the craftsmen, like, they all float around the world, and they've all floated to London. But the thing that impressed me the most about Dineg was they felt, and I think I told this to you, they felt like what Pixar felt to me in its first 10 years. It had this, it was a little ragtag and a little messy, almost like an artist like that just doesn't care about how they dress, they just want to get the painting done. But that's what I liked about it. I felt that their priorities were all about how did it get on the screen, how well did it get on the screen. And the animation sensibilities they had were pretty damn good. And so I felt like I was getting somebody on the curve going up of their talent. And as opposed to going off of past successes, and I've been there, I've seen that happen before, where they did these great things, but the people that you're now working with aren't the people that did that stuff. You know, again, I'm being on the inside, I know it's all about who you have, not about the name of the, it's all about who your players are, not the name of the team you have. And so they had great guys on DNA. And so I felt very comfortable feeling like anything that they hadn't experienced yet on long-form character animation, because that's what this film is. For as much as you may call it effect, it's most of the bulk of their work is main characters that exist in, you know, a large portion of the film, and many of them. And so from that standpoint, I had a lot of experience, and I thought I could fill the gap in on that for anything that they may not know, but I can't make them talented. And then Cinesite was really, really great at making very good-looking environments. And so that ended up sort of speaking for itself, because the workload was too big for any one house. We were able to sort of go, all right, we're going to go with the character animation with DNEG, and then we're going to go with the worlds and environments with Cinesite. And then we just got a big overload of stuff that we just, to make our dates, we ended up bringing an NPC, which is another really smart house that's, I think it's Motion Picture Company, is that what that NPC stands for? And gave them a standalone sequence in the film. But fortunately, they all literally are on the same block and a half in London. They all speak to each other. They're all used to having jobs that they may jointly be on top of. So it hasn't been some huge disconnect. It's been weird to do it remotely, though. I meet with them every morning. Just did it this morning where, you know, I'm linked at the end of their day is the beginning of mine. And we have dailies for anywhere from an hour to 2 hours. And it's been like that for a year now.
It's really exciting that you kept the character Edgar Rice Burroughs as mm-hmm. a fan of the original. I'm curious, what other things did you keep from the first book and what had to go?
Well, I tried to keep as much as I could. I didn't think of it that way. I didn't want to be trapped like that. I said, there were definitely scenes that I just... It's the same instinct you use when you're writing up, when you're outlining your own original idea. There are just some scenes that just jump out and you go, well, that has to be in the movie. Or there's something about that that is... Because I always treat it like an archaeological dig. It's stories are already out there, and you just uncover them. And you don't have a say when and which bones... When you find a bone and which bones you're going to find. And you may have to face the music somewhere along the line that you've dug up a different dinosaur than you thought. And are you going to have the intestinal fortitude to admit that instead of forcing it to be what you thought it was? And that's a lot of people say the story was speaking to me, or that's what the story wanted. That's the same sort of analogy. And so I did the same kind of gut thing. I sort of remember... You could just tell by flipping through the book that I notated, like, when things just completely became cinematic to me, and I could totally see this. And those became tent posts and then I knew the book so well, and so did Mark and Michael, that we just looked at it from story and story analysis, like we would do on any of our stuff. Like, if this is the theme, or if this is the character's arc, then... if this is where they have to go, then how do you make that work? And you hopefully have dismantled all the pieces and all the scenes that are in the book and put them in this toolbox so that you can grab any of those to possibly use. But your goal is not to, like, preserve that. You know, it's like trying to preserve your first draft. I'm not saying that the Prince of Mars was a first draft, but I read it and it. I'm sorry. I know it seems to offend some diehard fans, but it feels like a little bit of a train car, like there's these little mini beginning, middles, and ends, and sometimes within a chapter or a couple chapters together, and then it feels like it's just another train car situation. There's not this grand sense that it was all meant from a inner character arc and a inner thematic idea to happen. It plot-wise, it does. It plot-wise, that guy starts here and comes back, but not about something you're trying to say or a value that you're trying to express. And that's how I've been. That's what I do here is whether it's on other people's projects to advise or whether I'm doing it on my own, is to find those things and then strip away all the stuff that's not helping you in that or repurpose it. And so that's all we did with this over 2 or 3 years. And what I was shocked at was I didn't let myself look at the book because I didn't want to make anything sacred. I wanted to just go, what's best for this theme, this storyline, this character we're now telling? I wanted because that'll make the best movie. Great if I can pull from, like I said, that toolbox. And then, but what I was shocked is that when it was all up and we got the green light, I went back to look at the book. And I was like, "Oh, I thought we came up with that." Oh, I thought, you know, it's like they're all, and it made me feel very. I could sleep at night because I knew, oh, these things had a home. They were just in the wrong scene, or they were used improperly, or this person should be combined with this person. They were things that just made it a whole idea sing as one, and. But again, tried very hard to always be considerate of where we were going to go on a meta level so that I wasn't biting myself in the butt for all these things I liked or thought were cool in other stories and stuff. So it's easier to say than do, but we're trying our damnedest.
Time for one more question.
Obviously, in your fullness as a filmmaker, you're happy with his progress, but is that 12-year-old who is drawing Tharks in his neighbor garage, is he happy on the inside?
That's easy. The 12-year-old is so easy to please. It's the nearly 50-year-old that is now seen way too many movies and read too many books and is very jaded. Can I appease that person? Can I appease the, you know, when you see too many things of something you love done poorly, whether that be animation or fantasy or anything, you start to not become a fan of it. And I found myself starting to become more and more like, the last thing I want to see in animation, the last thing I want to see is a sci-fi movie. And it's not because I had lost the love for it. It's just that I love it too much to see it done half-assed or see it miss the mark. I'd rather just save my energy for when I think it's being done right. So I'm trying to appease that part. I'm trying to appease, you know, I'm always trying to do anything I work on. I'm trying to appease the part of me that wouldn't easily go to something like this, you know, for any film I'm working on. You know, again, I'm trying very hard not to think of other audience members. I'm always just trying to go, how can I not exclude anybody? How can I just make this satisfy me on as many levels as it could?
Thank you very kindly for your time, sir.
Thank you.
We'll see each other
again. Yeah, we're going to all go have lunch.